thank you very much for taking the time.
You're the Diagnosis Commission, right?
The Diagnosis Commission. What are the contributing causes to the financial crisis? That is our charge by the statute that was passed last year. And as I told Tim, who I suspect told you, one of the areas we're looking at now in depth is the role of derivatives in the financial crisis, the role of regulation or lack thereof of derivatives, and whether or not that contributed to the financial crisis. And, of course, who better to talk to about that than the chairman of the CFTC. So that's why we wanted to talk to you, and I will tell you what I've been doing with folks like you is really just asking the broad-based question in the beginning and then following up, and that is to get your opinions on what role, if any, derivatives played in either contributing to the financial crisis or acting as a propagating mechanism, what the role of regulation or lack thereof was, and since you are chairman of the CFTC, what role regulation should be playing now, since I know you guys are involved in a little legislation going on right now.
Okay. You want me to do that in 30 minutes or less, or in 7 minutes or less?
Yeah,
or
so we can follow up.
I think the financial system failed America. I think the regulatory system failed. It's not one or the other to me. I think the work of your commission is really important. I think derivatives played a role. I think it, though, wasn't the only factor. And I'll quickly touch upon some of the other factors that no doubt you're studying, you're well into the weeds of, and but then I'll talk about derivatives as long and as in depth as you want. But I think that we have, as a nation, very significant economic imbalances. You know, we went into this period of time with low and declining savings rates, and these are global imbalances, very high savings rates in Asia, particularly China and mm-hmm. out of the Middle East. I think we left the 90s with an asset bubble in the securities market that usually asset bubbles, not always, are a sign of imbalances in your whole economy, but that not directly, but we sort of moved into an asset bubble in the real estate market, both residential and commercial. I think a contributing factor, though there's great debate on it, was the low interest rates at the mm-hmm. Federal Reserve, the very easy monetary policies of the early decade. I appreciate and respect there are others that debate that and have a different view on it. But these global imbalances, you know, you get the evidence of it, very low savings rates, significant trade imbalances, of course, moving from budget surpluses to budget deficits. And you can see it also in the markets, that credit spreads, the spread that is being charged in markets for risk. It's basically a risk premium where was diminishing. The risk premium across a number of years in the mid-decade, whether it's measured in swap spreads, corporate bond spreads, the pricing of junk bonds, the risk premium. Now, risk is always within society. Risk is always within markets. But we had an asset bubble that also moved into the commodity markets, which is something the CFTC oversees, you know, the commodity markets. A second factor, well beyond those global imbalances, I think, is I just hit a few, I think, and I'm sure you're studying every one of these, but the mortgage underwriting practices and the whole pipeline from the we took a look at this when I was in the Clinton administration in 2000, to Andrew Cuomo's credit, and Larry Summers was then Treasury Secretary. I was asked to work with Andrew Cuomo, Michael Barr, and I would work with him. We went around the country and we sort of studied what was then called predatory lending. It seems like it picked up a different name later, subprime lending. But and we put out a report, the Treasury and HUD put out a report in the spring of 2000, had a series of recommendations about subprime lending, which was about predatory lending. Ned Graham, like at the Federal Reserve, was very helpful. I remember testifying with Ken Apgar of the FHA on a series of recommendations. They lasted on Capitol Hill a very short time. I mean, there wasn't much appetite or mood to take those recommendations. And even the recommendations that the Federal Reserve itself could do, the Federal Reserve didn't do. It was around, what was that law, HOPA, and the protections that you could have. I'm not suggesting that if everybody listened to the Joint Treasury HUD study in 2000, we wouldn't have this crisis. But just saying, these issues in the subprime marketplace, in some regards, the poor selling practices were known. The down the chain, the underwriting practices were starting to reveal themselves. But I think by the mid-decade, you had a lot of changes, and there was a lot of really bad practices in the chain. Starts with the mortgage finance companies. Many of them weren't federally regulated. I think we have a very patchwork quilt sort of environment for regulation. Not all, but most of the firms that came into trouble weren't even federally regulated in the mortgage, in the origination chain. Mm-hmm. But it goes all the way through the underwriting practices, all the way up to the main Wall Street firms as to how they were. So that gets to my next area is the rating agencies. I think they're gatekeepers. The gatekeeper function of underwriting, the gatekeeper function of rating agencies, I think very much broke down. And I'm not even suggesting it's a lack of regulation. I mean, I just think, and the rating agencies had for decades rated basically corporate bonds and state municipal bonds. But by the late 90s, you started to have these new structured deals. There's a whole opportunity for the rating agencies to grow and to build upon and to compete. The model was very much underwriter-directed, picking your rating agency, and you didn't have to pick three of them. Like, most corporations actually get two or three ratings, so interestingly, the rating agencies didn't necessarily have to compete as much, but I think in this structured product area, the rating agencies were very much remiss in their gate, sort of what I call the gatekeeper function, the critical review of these things. So it was a little bit, not a little bit, I think that's a key factor. There's a whole bunch of other things that I'll mention before I do derivatives, but I'm doing shortly. We didn't have consolidated supervision of complex financial institutions. This was something that was known even in the 1990s. I mean, as Europe went to a concept of consolidated supervision, they would raise it with U.S. regulators. You've got the holding. There's a Holding Company Act that came out of the 1950s. So banks, when they started to have multiple banks, you know, you might at first have multiple banks in the same state, and then by the 1970s and 80s, I guess 1980s, you start to have them cross states. Concept of a holding company, so the Federal Reserve was that. But when the investment banks started to do affiliate structures, you had the SEC regulating the broker-dealer, but nobody technically had regulation of their affiliates. Mm-hmm. You've probably studied the, what's that, CSE program over at the SEC? Yeah. But there was no effective consolidated supervision of the investment banks. There was no effective consolidated supervision of anything that had an OTS label on it. So AIG fell into that category. So I think that's another, that was a real gap in the system, consolidated. And that means consolidated capital, consolidated risk management across the whole platforms. I think the capital standards themselves played a role in this. That partly in Europe, Basel III, I think, left a lot of holes, but CSE program, Basel II, I'm sorry, that the CSE program picked up the capital standards of Basel II as well, you know, the risk management approach there. And it plays into derivatives, which I'm going to hold a little bit on, but I mean, I think that's part that the capital standards. And then the last thing I want to mention before I talk to derivatives, I think modern finance and probably finance of the future will never repeal that the tendency of a crowd to all want to get to the door at the same time. And call it the classic runs on the bank. And that wonderful 1946 movie, It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey has his little savings and loan, and all the depositors want to, you know, get the money out. The angel, of course, got, you know, we had an angel, you know. We didn't quite have an angel in this scenario, but the modern run in this crisis you saw in several scenarios, but you saw it in money markets when the reserve fund broke the buck that Wednesday of the fateful week. You saw it in prime brokerage relationships between hedge funds and investment banks when, after Lehman failed, there was so much intense, severe pressure on Merrill, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman that the prime brokerage relationships would pull all of those securities out. That's technically pulling out the stock loan and the tri-party repo. But what I think, and I don't think we'll repeal that. I think the tendency to crowds to all want to get through a narrow opening in one moment of crisis, you know, is something that, rather than saying we're ever going to repeal that, we have to make sure that we build our financial institutions and regulations to anticipate some of that. The runs on the bank of the George Bailey circumstance is very different now. But I think what failed is these institutions, whether it was the largest amongst them, Citicorp or others, I think had a fundamental mismatch and a weak appreciation for what happens to liquidity and funding in crisis. And I think that these large financial institutions here in the U.S. and in Europe had a tremendous, I would say, over-reliance on short-term funding that could have been in the money market desk, through tri-party repo, through stock loan, so forth. Which, of course, all of that was then getting their money from the mutual fund industry. The money market was about $3.6 trillion in money markets. That in a crisis, when that gets pulled, their assets were always illiquid. Now, some could say, listen, that's what financial intermediation is. Financial intermediation at its core is bringing together people who have money and people that need money, and you stand in the middle of that. It's bringing to people that have a risk and want to lay off that risk, and somebody who's willing to bear the risk. You can think of insurance in a way. But also financial intermediation is about maturity mismatches. You know, George Bailey has a maturity mismatch. All those depositors give him money, and then he puts it out in 30-year mortgages. Mm-hmm. The maturity mismatch is something at the core of financial institutions. But I think that the regulators just haven't had enough cushions for liquidity runs. And that many of the assets of Lehman Brothers were probably terribly mismarked, that your study of Lehman Brothers will be about a lot of issues about how they did 105 repos and how they put things off balance sheet. And your study of the big banks will be how they put stuff off into special purpose things called sieves and so forth. But I also think that on the asset side, they were fundamentally misjudging how illiquid these things were just because they put it inside of a loan. Lehman Brothers had a lot of things that they called commercial loans. Now, if you make a $100 million loan against a building that's worth $105 million, it is a loan, but now the building's worth $95 million a month or two later, it feels like more like you own the building. So is it real estate or a loan? So I think that's my last thing before derivatives. I could go on, but you guys have a lot of fun. You got a lot to study. Derivatives. Is this what you guys want me to cover?
Yes.
No, let me just say a little bit of background on derivatives. Derivatives in our country started in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. In 1865, just before, I guess, Lee and Grant were meeting in Virginia, some other people were meeting often. It's true. It's when it was. It was just a few weeks before they were meeting. Off in Chicago, some grain merchants and millers and everything figured out that to hedge a risk in corn and wheat, they would no longer just enter into what was called a forward contract. A forward contract would be that sometime a few months from now, I'll deliver the corn and you'll give me money. Mm-hmm. Somebody invented what was called a futures contract. It was that a few months from now at harvest time, I might deliver the corn and you might give me the money, but I also have a right to financially settle that contract. I don't have to physically deliver. That was the great innovation in 1865 that started the derivatives market. A futures contract was just simply that somebody planting and growing and milling corn or wheat could protect themselves against the future price of corn or wheat and would not have to actually physically deliver the corn or wheat or not physically take it into their stocks. It was also a way to discover prices on a more national or regional basis than just what the local fellow would buy it for. It took nearly 60 years to first regulate that. In the early 20s, the Grain Act was passed, right, Dan? Do I have it about right? Went all the way to the Supreme 22. It went all the Supreme Court, and then it was declared unconstitutional, actually, because they said it might not have to do with interstate commerce. Well, they fixed it. They put a couple of different clauses in, and they did it again. The core thing, and then by 1936, just the same way that Roosevelt went to Congress and said we have to protect the securities markets against manipulation, Roosevelt went to Congress and said we have to protect these commodities markets, but it was fundamentally derivatives markets from manipulation. They were all agricultural commodity derivatives at that time. There was no interest rate swaps. There was no oil swaps. But the fundamental things that were done then was they had to be on transparent exchanges, and it was a mandate. All of them had to be on exchanges. And they give some authority, our predecessors, some anti-fraud and anti-manipulation authorities, of course. And then there was an innovation from the 1890s called clearinghouses. Clearinghouses are just middlemen that stand between a purchaser of a derivative and a seller of a derivative, and on a daily basis ask for performance money to be posted because they're valuing that derivative on a daily basis. This history will be relevant. So that's about where it stood, but then you get to the early 70s and people start to do derivatives on equities. They were called stock options, but they were a form of derivative. An option is a form of a derivative, and they started to do it on a centralized exchange out in Chicago, and there was this debate, what do we do about that, how do we regulate it, and so forth. And so what came out of that period of time is our predecessor got pushed out of the Agriculture Department, got broad new authorities over all of what was called futures. Futures are basically on-exchange derivatives. So we picked up authority for oil futures and financial futures and so forth. And by 1980, probably, all derivatives contracts were on exchanges, and the majority were financial. By 1980, they were mostly on the equity markets, or they might have just started on the euro-dollar contract in the late 70s, I think. Well, in 1981, over at Salomon Brothers, somebody brokered a trade between World Bank and IBM on a currency derivative, or at least the story goes. And the start of what was off-exchange derivatives or unregulated derivatives occurred. They initially were bilateral. They were initially actually brokered. They weren't taken onto the bank's books. But within several years, all the banks said, we're going to, this is a line of business. We'll actually take the thing right onto our books. They sort of operated as the central clearer in a way without asking for performance money. They were customized, and of course we didn't live in the world where people could walk in with a computer. You know, there were no computers. I'm old enough to remember.
So were we.
Yeah. I don't think your colleague is. There were debates. There were debates as early as probably 87, 88. Our agencies got reauthorized every about 5 years. There was a big debate in 92. What do we do about these things now that were called swaps? So derivatives are futures and swaps. The on-exchange derivatives, fully regulated, and they're called futures. These off-exchange derivatives, which were mostly bilateral, customized, not done in any central place, no central clearing. Mm-hmm. What do we do? And late in the 80s and by 92, there was a growing sort of pressure from Congress, probably from industry, maybe even from the regulators, that this needed to be addressed. So in 1992, I guess, in our reauthorization, there was a provision that we'd have an exemption authority. And we were specifically sort of suggested in the committee report, not in statute, that we use the exemptive authority to exempt this whole class. And Wendy Graham was chairman then, and before she left in January of 93, she put out the swaps exemption. There was a swaps policy statement three, four, 5 years earlier. We can summarize all this history, but I'm just trying to, I mean, but the swaps policy statement, either in the late 80s or early 90s, do you remember when it was?
Late 80s.
Yeah. The swaps policy statement in the late 80s, and then the exemption. Congress granted the exemptive authority, so, I mean, in a sense, Chairman Graham used the exemptive authority that was this. The thinking at the time, we can look back now and say things should have been done differently and all that, but the thinking at the time, I think, was, I captured this in a speech I gave up at Columbia University with Joe Stiglitz asked me to go up there, and I did this a month or two ago. We could send you that one. But I think, and even through the late 90s, you know, because I could go through the Brooksley situation too. Well, let me just go through the history, and then I'll give you the thing of the time. So there's also a really critical moment there. The Brent crude oil thing was about then too. There was this whether a contract that was traded on Brent crude was a future and should be on an exchange. It went into a court situation. The court said it could be a future, it was a future. And so one of the other things that happened in 93 is there was also that was exempted here. So there was two things, one under Graham, but the Brent thing I think happened a few months after she left. Can't remember.
The energy exemption was a few months after.
Yeah, so the energy exemption was a few months later. The thing got attested a little bit when Mary was in my job, Mary Shapiro was in this job, in a Mattel-Gesellschaft case. She tried to sort of test the outer boundaries. The question, the legal question was, were swaps futures? Because our statutory language at the time said futures had to be on exchanges. It didn't say derivatives. It said futures. And so there was a legal question, are swaps futures? Everybody knew that swaps and futures were pretty similar, but were they technically futures? That was this legal question. Throughout the 80s, people said, really not. But, you know, as you got into the 90s, they started to have some characteristics. Wendy Graham's swap exemption was they had to be bilateral, They had to be individually negotiated. They thirdly couldn't be on central clearing. Let's see, individually negotiated, bilateral, not cleared. She had a fourth characteristic. I don't know. Still in our Part 35. You could find it in Part 35. So that was the sort of conceptual framework. Mary sort of tested a little this futures swaps thing in the Mattel-Gesellschaft case. There was a lot of back pressure. The case got settled. Mary went over to NASDAQ. And then Brooksley came. A critical thing in the history is also the SEC. There was a little bit of turf thing going on with the SEC, too. Mm-hmm. The SEC did something called Broker Lite in late 97, where the investment banks wanted to set up affiliates to do derivatives business. The question is, how do they get regulated? The broker-dealers didn't want to keep their swaps business in the broker-dealers. They wanted to do, I can use the term, be capitally efficient, or use capital arbitrage, if you wish, and put it in an affiliate, not in the broker-dealer. And somewhere late in 97, there was something called Broker Lite. I can't remember its details. Maybe Cyrus remembers the details.
Basically, Basel II, and that you used internal risk weighting methods
for
to calculate the requirement for broker-dealer life, and that enabled them to get a higher credit rating so that all their counterparties could treat them as though they were, if not double
right.
A, even
right,
higher.
Right, right.
So it was capital efficient, not just for, if you will, Goldman and Morgan and Merrill, but for their counterparties as
right.
well. And that was, I understand part of that motivation.
Yeah.
It was also to get away from Basel I and get into that internal right. risk weighting of Basel II.
I think, though, as sometimes happens with regulators, it also then became a little bit of a, you know, that was an SEC thing, it wasn't a bank thing, it wasn't a CFTC thing. I mean, there's probably a little of that, too. The investment banks then did, and this is part of the rating agency story, too, started to have swaps affiliates that they would then go out and work with the rating agencies to get credit ratings on to try to do triple. They were single A. They were single A. Goldman, Morgan, Stanley, and so forth, single A. But they try to get their affiliate to be triple A or double A at least, where they would do credit enhancements and they'd work with the rating agencies, highly negotiated, to get those swaps affiliates. I think the missed opportunity, and we raised it in 1998. After long-term capital management fell in 98, I guess it was in spring of 99, the Treasury and the President's Working Group did a report on long-term capital management. And it was basically a report on excess leverage and how to deal with high, I guess it was the report's name was How to Deal with Highly Leveraged Institutions. It had a series of recommendations. Some of which related to markets and bank regulation, but some related to Congress. One of them was that we needed enhanced regulation of these swaps affiliates. There was a footnote in the report because Greenspan and Rubin didn't agree on this. I remember because I had to personally negotiate between the two of them as a staffer. I mean, I was an assistant secretary, but I was like taking each of their language and trying to get the footnote at the time. So the issue of regulating the swaps affiliates was known in that report in the spring of 99. It was recommended mm-hmm. with a lack of concurrence from Greenspan, but it was sort of it's buried in a footnote, the lack of concurrence.
Mm-hmm.
This agency, under Brooksley's leadership, put out the concept release in the spring of 98. You all know that history, you know, well. It kicked up the same legal question, or swaps futures or futures, you know, derivatives, that whole. It was in the context that Europe didn't regulate derivatives and Asia didn't regulate derivatives, but it was in that context. And then the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, which I'm not, you know, I mean, I could go through, but you kind of have...
Mm-hmm.
But I think the five things, and Scott could send you the thing because Scott helps me in all my speeches and he runs the press area. The five things as to why I think These are just my views. These aren't CFTC views. Right? But I think the five areas that I think of that why, over these decades, why Europe, Asia, and the U.S. didn't bring this under regulation, because it's not just here. Mm-hmm. I think that they're sort of, first, there are three somewhat intertwined assumptions, but let me see if I can remember them without the speech in front of me. One assumption was that the parties to these contracts were all sort of sophisticated parties. Mm-hmm. Big girls, big boys, you know, large enough to fend for themselves. Two was that that the institutions that were operating as dealers, what we are now calling swap dealers, were basically regulated anyway. And three, that somehow that market discipline amongst these sophisticated parties with the institutions generally regulated anyway would kind of work. That third one sometimes associated with Chairman Greenspan, but I mean, the first assumption that they're all sort of large, sophisticated actors, and so do they need protections? I think, sort of in a sense, it's proven out to ignore that there's larger, broader, more, you know, systemic implications. Even if you're saying, even if you believed, and I'm not saying I do, but even if you believed there wasn't a need to, you know, protect individual actors. We're actually, this gets into our recommendations, we're proposing, and it looks like we may be able to be successful in this, that the SEC and CFTC have explicit rule-writing authority to protect business conduct for fraud, manipulation, and other abuses in this marketplace. But that would have been unheard of through this debate, that this sophisticated marketplace should have such protections of fraud, manipulation, and other abuses. This second assumption that kind of these actors were well kind of regulated anyway, and I would say, even looking back, because I was part of the Clinton administration, though I was recused during the year with Brooksley and my boss, the secretary, was having that sort of thing, because I was just in my first year from Goldman Sachs, I would say that I was probably prone to this false assumption too, the second assumption. Is that the large dealers were regulated. Where that breaks down is it wasn't really true for a lot of them. The affiliates of the investment banks, the AIG affiliate, they weren't really effectively regulated. And even if you were in the middle of a bank, even if you were in the middle of a large bank and you were regulated by the bank regulators, you weren't explicitly regulated for capital. To this day, you cannot go to the OCC or the Federal Reserve's or BAL's website and say, where is the capital rules just for your swap business? It's sort of like it's embedded in everything else. It's not explicit. There's not explicit rules about how to do netting and back office documentation and so forth. But certainly, as the case of AIG proves in spades, there was no effective consolidated holding company regulation, and thus there was no effective regulation of its derivative affiliate. There was no, I would contend, no effective consolidated holding company regulation of the investment banks. The CSE program didn't really, I mean, it was better than what was before, maybe, that there was somebody looking into the affiliates, but very light, probably. Mm-hmm. The third assumption I never really believed much in, but you know, there's too many externalities. There's just too many externalities to leave it to chance. The fourth and fifth thing that I think of is there was always this sort of thing that these hedging transactions are highly customized and bilateral. That was absolutely the case in 1981. That may have still been the case in 1993, January 93, when Chairman Graham put out this swaps exemption. Well, my problem is it's my daughter. So let me just do this for a second, I think. The other assumption was that they were bilateral, they're basically highly tailored, they're not susceptible to centralized market structures. I think that's something that was probably way true in the 80s, became less true in the 90s, became a lot less true once computerization took off. You know, in 1993, when Chairman Graham put out that thing, there was really no internet. I mean, you could sort of go do the statistics. And even in the late 90s, there was no electronic trading. I mean, the New York Stock Exchange was still very much a specialist system. The derivatives markets in Chicago and New York, what we call the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the and New York, NYMEX, were in the pits, were on the floor. And in the late 90s, you just started, 98, 99, to have a little bit of this starting. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act provided some provisions. It was meant to sort of capture some of those emerging issues. Some of them didn't take off. There was something called DTEFs put into that, but Jeff Sprecher started ICE as an exempt commercial market. But there was just beginning that electric platform. So I think the last 10 years there's been a lot of evolution towards centralization. In front of your commission, Jamie Dimon was asked by Brooks Liborn what percentage of the market could be brought to central clearing, and he said in January, 75 to 80%. I want to thank you all for having that question, because I quote that often now in speeches. I've seen him since then at one meeting, and he said, well, maybe 70 to 80%. But he still, you know, the point being that would not have been the answer 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And certainly 20 years ago. That the standardization in this market has, in whatever the standardization, whatever the number is, it's far greater today than it was before. And the last thing is, I think, was debated about why these should be regulated, not regulated, and so forth, is, well, we can't do it here, it will all go overseas. You know, sort of that whole thing. That's a real live issue at all times. It's even in what we're doing right now. We have a remarkable confluence of views between Europe and the U.S. I think we have very good views between the U.S. and Mexico and Canada and Tokyo. We've been sort of walking this derivatives legislation through internationally. But we still will end up with different cultures and different political systems with a little variation in this. And there'll be some gaps. I think you cannot diminish the influence of it, that these contracts were not regulated in Europe and Asia and anywhere else has even on the mindset here in this country. So they tell me I have to leave, but you want to know what role derivatives played in the crisis? I think it was a very real role. I think it was a role and I'm going to summarize, but I think over-the-counter derivatives are important hedging tools for corporate and municipal governments. But they do allow for risks to be concentrated. They're meant to be risk management tools and to lower risk for the users. And they generally do that. They don't always do that, but they generally do that. But at the same time that they do generally do that for the end users, they have tended to concentrate and heighten risk within this financial institutions. Financial institutions, when they started this in the 80s, started brokering these transactions, but quickly decided to keep them on their books. Mm-hmm. And as the business grew, they found that very profitable. They charge for the credit extension, because you're extending credit when you're doing these transactions. But they'd also charge for the market making. They were not moved to central clearing, so the risk stayed within these books. And in the United States today, there's really five large financial institutions that have the bulk of this business, 95 plus, and you might say there's 5 to 8 overseas. Now, we could give you a list of 25 swap dealers, but you know, when you really say where it's a highly concentrated mm-hmm. and dealer-dominated business. It's not unusual. The airline industry got concentrated, the auto industry, the drug industry. But this has enormous externalities to the, you know, I think. And I think it does heighten and concentrate risk. That's why I'm such an advocate that we mandate central clearing, that we move as much as we can off of the books of these. Mm-hmm. AIG, I think, highlighted those risks because when the money went into AIG, the first $90 billion, $60 billion of it went straight through AIG to other counterparties. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was fulfilling counterparty claims both on their swaps books and I think on their stock loans. So it's not the first 60 wasn't all because of derivatives. I think a second thing to consider about how they can heighten it, so I'm still in my first point of heightening and concentrating risk, but if you want to make it a separate point altogether, over-the-counter derivatives can add to the leverage in the system. Leverage is usually thought of as how many dollars of borrowings do you have for every dollar of capital. That's the classic, you know, first semester finance answer what leverage is. But in the modern world, you can put a lot of that same borrowing, if you wish, in the form of an over-the-counter derivative. And so it can add a great deal of risk. Long-term capital management, I had the phone call on a Saturday in 1998 to go up to long-term capital management, where the secretary then, Rubin, asked me to go up. And Peter Fisher from the New York Fed and I went over there. Well, they had a $1.3 trillion derivatives book, and they had a $100 billion balance sheet. And, of course, not $100 billion of capital. They had about $4 billion of capital. Mm-hmm. So the $4 billion of capital in this hedge fund was levered 25 to 1. The derivatives book of $1.3 trillion notional amount doesn't necessarily mean that's a leverage ratio. I don't want to mistake people and say, oh, my God, that's 200, 325 to 1. No, it's not like that, but you can put so much risk in an off-balance sheet derivatives book that then is also riding on top of that small. And I think that we saw that in large measure, of course, at AIG, less so elsewhere, but I wouldn't diminish that it was elsewhere. The second big thing about how derivatives played a role in this is in the whole mortgage securitization chain. That whole chain we were talking about earlier. Derivatives and credit default swaps, more specifically, were used in that chain. Credit default swaps didn't really exist. They were a blip on the screen. I will tell you, in 2000, and I didn't participate in every meeting on this Commodity Futures Modernization Act. It wasn't, I mean, you know, there was a team of people at the Federal Reserve and at Treasury and the CFTC and the SEC. But the meetings that I was in, I never remember the word credit default swap coming up. Hmm. And what I'm sure of is nobody ever, like said, let's have a whole meeting on it. But what I'm saying is I don't even remember it coming up. It's possible. It's possible somebody will put in front of me a piece of paper that has the words on it and will have my name on it. But it was such a small part of the market, and it was just starting to happen over J.P. Morgan and so forth. But that product by 2004 and 2005 was being used in a way in this securitization chain that I think had some very adverse effects. People were effectively selling their credit rating. AIG was renting for what in hindsight was too cheap a premium, but they were renting their AAA rating that they used to have. Through credit default swaps, foremost into these collateralized debt pools, but also to European banks. European banks, I don't want to diminish, European banks had, I think, $300 billion of credit default swaps with AIG. I can't remember. AIG had $450 billion of credit default swaps, and either one-third was to Europe or two-thirds. I just apologize. I can't remember. But
it's mostly Europe.
Mm-hmm. So two-thirds. So about $300 billion was to Europe. And the European bank regulators were taking the AIG credit and lowering the capital charges to the European banks.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect of it was that AIG was a house of cards that came down. And this is part of how it concentrated and heightened risk, is because it's so interconnected, that the financial system writ large was so interconnected by all the derivative trades between them. Clearinghouses can compress all that, can take a lot. And the first $7 billion of credit default swaps that are now in ICE, you should interview Jeff Sprecher about this, but ICE Trust has about seven. You would think that's $7 trillion out of the $28 trillion notional is now in ICE Trust. I think they've found on average there's, I think he said to me recently, 15 parties when you do the chain. Somebody buys it, somebody sells it, somebody buys it, somebody sells it, somebody buys it. So when all of this book of business is coming in, they're finding out that the daisy chain is compressing, and instead of $7 trillion, it's like 1/15th or 20th of it or something. Oh, no, it's well less than a trillion. That it compresses down, I think, to like $500 or $600 billion. You could ask Jeff. You can. But back to the story. So it heightened and concentrated risk. I think, secondly, it was very much a part of this mortgage underwriting chain. Now, you know, it's very topical. I'm sure part of your report will look at synthetic CDOs and so forth. Mm-hmm. But even if they weren't synthetic CDOs, what was happening is, it's like the old bond underwriting thing. I mean, we should know it. One of the early signs of this crisis was Bear Stearns' problems, but it was also that MBIA and AMBAC, bond underwriters, who were selling as insurance companies what used to be called in the trade bond wraps, where they were wrapping their credit rating. They were selling cheap insurance so somebody could get their credit rating. I can't remember which month in 08, but they went down well before September, right? I mean, that was like, what's that?
January, the New York State Insurance Department had big concerns to everybody together.
So right. So there was 8 to 10, MBIA, AMBAC, and obviously AIG, but there was like 7 to 10 others that were basically selling credit default swaps, heavily. They're probably all under now. I don't even know the list. But mostly to this mortgage chain that, of course, is in the context of, you know, an asset bubble. Like, if you know, but which came first? What created the asset bubble? You know, and everybody do some of this. But, you know, is it our global imbalances? Is it poor underwriting practices? Is it credit default swaps? Is it poor underwriting standards where the investment banks were sort of shoveling in and shoveling out? But I think derivatives played a very central role to this mortgage underwriting chain through credit derivatives. I think I'm probably out of time. What else are we going to say? If they ever ask us to testify, what else am I going to say, Cyrus? Because you're thinking about this. How did derivatives...
Look, I think part of the interconnectedness story is the and the opacity of the market, I think, contributed to some of the runs that you were talking about. So when a counterparty doesn't know what kind of a derivatives counterparty their counterparty is involved with, it increases the uncertainty.
The on-exchange derivatives markets, futures, have had a discipline really since the 1890s, but by mandate, by law, since the 1930s, to use central clearing.
Mm-hmm.
But clearing has a mandate within itself that every day to value the transaction, and the obligation of each of the parties is to send some money. Somebody will send some money one way or the other. This marketplace, when it grew up at first in the 80s and 90s, there was no central clearing. There's a little bit of central clearing, voluntary clearing now, but only in the last 10 years. But Cyrus is absolutely right. The interconnectedness is there. I have to go. The interconnectedness is there, but it then, has to be coupled with, as Cyrus used a fancy lawyer word, opacity. I would say darkness, but I'm a finance guy, and he got his PhD in history. It's true, isn't it?
Yes.
What happens in Iran, go back to George Bailey's situation, but what happens in Iran is everybody's running for safety. When I said it's everybody trying to get out the door, think of a theater and somebody screams fire. I mean, just think of the visual. That's how financial markets work in a crisis or a panic. We had a little of that on May 6th that we're studying now, the SEC and we are studying. So everybody's trying to run to safety. And derivatives in that moment that are not centrally cleared create more uncertainty. Will my counterparty be able to perform? And I have a 30-year open contract, a 30 or 20-year open contract on oil or interest rates or whatever, but will they be able to perform? Mm-hmm. And if I'm worried that they won't be able to perform, I'm not going to enter into any more trades with them, but I'm also going to try to find any way that my lawyers can trigger the current trades. I think that's what you're referring to. Whereas the central clearinghouse model, it can't do it for 100% of the market, but if Jamie Dimon's right and says it's 75 to 80% of the market, that's a heck of a step forward to put three-quarters of the market into the central clearinghouse functions. I think in September of 2008, the biggest story in derivatives was clearly AIG. I've been accused by some opponents to reform that we're using AIG to try to ride to get all of this stuff. Those people would say it's all about a couple of things. They would say it's only about consolidated supervision. If we only had reform to bring consolidated supervision, AIG should have had somebody looking over the whole thing. And secondly, it's about credit default swaps. Credit default swaps mean lots of regulation. I would say that would be the core, the opponents would say. When President Obama's transition was meeting, and it was then just Tim Geithner and Mary Shapiro and myself, not like, you know, big buildings with lots of staff, none of the three of us thought it was just that. I mean, it was all, we have to cover the whole product suite. Interest rate derivatives, currency derivatives, oil and commodity derivatives, equity, credit default swaps. So the whole suite of products, and that it wasn't just about regulating the dealers, the swap dealers being the consolidated supervision, but we had to have a mandate for clearing. And then the toughest political question was whether we had a mandate for trading. But we basically, by January of 2009, sitting in that, I remember that office, that transition office, said let's, I mean, it took a lot more months to get this all written up, but let's do the whole product suite, you know, and let's not just focus on the dealers, but the three key components of reform are comprehensive dealer regime, mandatory clearing for that 75 or 80% that can be cleared. And then what was most politically charged was a mandate to bring as much of that 75%, maybe not all of the 75%, but as much of it to some central trading. And if there's not enough liquidity for the trading, at least have real-time post-transaction reporting. So that's the story. Next time you interview me, I might have a different story. But I think it's still very relevant. What's the history of how did derivatives play a role in this particular crisis? I think they magnified and concentrated risk and leverage. And I secondly think that they had a very, I would say, corrosive role in the mortgage underwriting process. The whole mortgage underwriting and securitization chain. Those would be the two things that I would have to prove out. I mean, Cyrus would have to prove out in my written testimony. And then, you know, if you wanted me to talk anything about the history, I mean, I think the history, which I captured in that Columbia speech, is just, you know, that, I mean, certainly I think about it now. Knowing what we know now, should those of us, you know, that were in those roles back then done more? Yeah. But we didn't know then what we know now. And these assumptions, these five assumptions, you know, you have this sort of broad international debate that would peak up in 87 or 88, 92, 98, you know, and each time that the debates, and they probably had their other debates in Europe too, I think those were some of the factors why people said, no, maybe not. It's really an institutional market. We're kind of regulating these folks anyway. You know, they're kind of unique and bilateral, you know, those points.
Digest so quickly, but you just said it had a corrosive role in mortgage origination process.
Mortgage underwriting and syndication.
By making it seem safer by taking or
I think that not on the streets of, you know, Seattle or Baltimore or anywhere where somebody was getting I think that there were bad practices by subprime brokers. Mm-hmm. I don't think it had a direct role there. I think further down the chain, I should have said if I did, mortgage underwriting and mortgage securitization. I think, but you have to take, I mean, I don't know if you'll do it this way, but a mortgage all the way from, you know, the homeowner all the way to the other end that's packaged in a, you know, sliced up synthetic CDO. I think they did have a corrosive effect further down the chain in terms of the underwriting practices and the syndications. Because in the syndications and underwriting practices, they basically, when you leave parties, investors, with a sense that they have less risk, they'll pay more for something. It's part of what leads to a bubble when risk is mispriced. I mean, fundamentally, though there were many causes of the crisis, one of the big central themes of the crisis is risk is always in society, but it sometimes gets mispriced. And I think risk got seriously mispriced in this. The risk of individual homeowners defaulting, the risk overall of an asset bubble declining, or people didn't call it a bubble, just the risk that housing prices would decline was underpriced. And the other risk that I think was significantly underpriced was the earlier risk I talked about, liquidity risk, which doesn't directly relate to derivatives. But I think liquidity risk was fundamentally underpriced. I think the risk that overall asset values would decline was underpriced and underappreciated. I think the risk of homeowner default was ultimately, and the rating agencies played a role, bad underwriting practices played a role, but credit default swaps played a role in that. That helped.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out the
We really have to stop.
Sam!
Iron-fisted Mr. Karpoff.
Come on, everybody's got to have a Mr. Karpoff.
You're right. You're right.